chapter 2 this morning. Nehemiah chapter 2. Next week, looking forward to the children's presentation. They worked hard. We can hear them downstairs in Sunday school today as they're working up here to get that together. All right, Nehemiah chapter 2. But first, let's open up with a little story, shall we? There were two old men living in the backwoods. The two men's names were Rufus and Clarence. They lived on the opposite sides of a river, and they did not get along. Every morning, just after sunrise, Rufus and Clarence would stomp down to the river on their own side and begin to yell at one another. "Rufus," Clarence said, "you better thank your lucky stars that I can't swim, or I'd swim over there and whoop you." Oh, well, Clarence on the other side, Clarence Rufus would holler back, "You better thank your lucky stars that I can't swim, or I'd come over and whoop you." Well, every morning, every day, for 20 years, this went on. 20 years. Well, one day, to both Rufus and Clarence's surprise, a group of engineers showed up at the river and built a bridge. But still, every day, for 5 years, they stood on each other's side of the river and said the same thing. "If you better thank your lucky stars that I can't swim, or I'd come over there and whoop you." Well, the voice of reason, Rufus's wife, came down and said, "Rufus," she said one day, "I just can't take it no more. Every day for 25 years, you've been threatening to whoop Clarence." "Well, there's a bridge. Get her done." Well, Rufus stood there and thought for a moment, chewed on his bottom lip, and says, "You're right." He declared, snapping his suspenders into place, "I'm going to go down and whoop Clarence right now." So he walked down, opened up the door, down the river, stomped all the way to the riverbank, came to the bridge, stepped onto that bridge, walked about halfway across that bridge, and his wife was standing up there so proud of her husband. But then all of a sudden, he turned around, ran back up the house, slammed the door, bolted the window shut, grabbed the shotgun, and dove underneath the bed. And Rufus cried his wife, "I thought you were going to go down there and whoop Clarence." "Well, I was. I was," he whispered. "Shh. What is the matter?" his wife asked. "Well," whispered the terrified Rufus, "I walked halfway over the bridge and I saw a sign that said, 'Clarence, 13 feet, 6 inches.' He never looked that big before." I really like that story. Although, it's a funny illustration, which is true, but I wonder for just a moment what Christians, if we could, just as Christians, just humbly look at our circumstances from far away. When we look at our circumstances, they look rather small and insignificant, but by the time that those rough or hard or difficult circumstances or confrontations come closer, it looks so much bigger than what they really appeared to be. Is that right? And we have the temptation at times, and maybe I should just include me. Maybe you're not like this. We have the temptation at times, or at least I do, when you get closer to any type of difficult circumstance or something that looks so big, you want to just turn around and run away. Today we're going to look at the story of Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah was a far distance away, even in another land, and heard about this big task that he was about to take on. And we're going to look at, in chapter 1, we learn that this was a godly burden that God placed on his heart. And it affected him so much so that he took some significant time to pray. Which, by the way, this Wednesday, we have an opportunity as a congregation to come together and pray. I trust that you would consider making that part of your week. You know, there's no better time of sweet fellowship that we can come together as a dear little family where we can give God some time to pray together. We don't do that very often here. You used to do it every Wednesday. Every Wednesday. But for whatever reason, that disappeared. Well, I know why. But we're not going to talk about that this morning. That we'll leave that for another time. But, maybe it might come up in some of the illustrations. We'll see. Is there a task so big in your life right now that God has placed in your heart that you would be like Rufus and just tuck tail and turn and run? Or are we going to look at Nehemiah's illustration and see how he responded to a godly burden in his life? All right, well, let's look at this. Because there's a lot of cool things that we can pull out of this story. Maybe we should read it first before I go from slide to slide. Let's read this first. We're going to read all of Nehemiah chapter 2. It's 20 verses. So why don't you look in your scriptures that you have hopefully on your lap this morning. I'll be reading, of course, as I usually do, from the English Standard Version. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Okay, so we got to remember who is talking in first person here. This is Nehemiah now, okay? Now, I had not been sad in his presence. That's a significant statement. Verse 2. The king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing that you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. Again, another significant statement. Why would somebody be so afraid to express a little bit of grief here or trouble? We'll get to that. Verse 3, I said to the king, "Let the king live forever." So he responds in a very formal throne room etiquette way. Okay, very respectful, very gentle. "Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Verse 4. Then the king said to me, "Well, what are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." The king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "Well, how long will you be gone, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. Also very significant. And I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy." And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of God was upon me. Verse 9. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite's servant heard this, it displeased them greatly, or some of your versions may say it greatly angered them, that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. They were angered about this. Verse 11. So I went to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. And I told no one what my God put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. Not yet. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that I was that was under me to pass. That's just explaining how bad the destruction was. Okay, it's horrible. Verse 15. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered the valley gate and so returned. Verse 16. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. That's a curious statement again, but also very important. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Also very significant. Verse 17. Then I said to them, here it comes. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in? How Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned? Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. And I told them of the hand of my God had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem, here's now a third one to oppose them, the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, what is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. So, we're going to look at the story of Nehemiah, maybe, here. So there's three parts. First of all, we're going to look at the name of the message titled, How to Respond to a Godly Burden, because last week we talked about the power of a godly burden. And by the way, I had some just incredible conversations with some of you about godly burdens, and I'm just thankful that God is working in your life. And we also have a collective godly burden here at Bethany. We've all chosen to be part of this family, and I shared a little bit about that last week, about the collective godly burden that we are kind of building our ministry around. And I'll bring that up just to remind you, just in case either you weren't here or forgot or just hadn't connected yet. So how to respond to a godly burden, Nehemiah 2, 1-20. So there's three parts of the message. First of all, to respond to a godly burden, we need to wait patiently for God's timing and pray and plan. So let's go back to verse 1 now. Everybody look back. Now it says, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. First of all, that timing is important, because if you go back to chapter 1, it gives you a different time. So the time difference between chapter 1 and chapter 2 is 4 months. 4 months is the time between those 2 months. And you think, boy, that's a long time to wait. You know, you got this godly burden on your heart, and you want to just go for it. You want to just act on it. You're getting a little itchy, and you got ants in your pants kind of thing, and you just want to get going. But for some reason, Nehemiah waited. And here for 4 months. And when you think about it, really, waiting 4 months is not that long. I know some of us in this room have been waiting for a long time for different things in their life. Maybe even a lifetime of burden that for whatever reason, God has not sought fit yet to grant that burden of yours. And I'm going to suggest there's reasons to why that is. And frankly, we may not like it. So just hold on, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But when you think about some of the characters in the scriptures that waited, you think of guys like Abraham, waited 25 years for him to get Isaac. Joseph spent time as Potiphar's slave, and then for 2 years he spent in prison until anything happened for his circumstances to change. 2 years in prison. Israel was enslaved for over 400 years. They waited for their emancipation. Moses spent 40 years in the desert before God did anything to change his situation. The nation of Israel, along with Moses, spent 40 years in the wilderness. David spent, you know, his entire 20s running from King Saul. I can go down through the list. The idea in Scripture of waiting is there. We may not like it if you're anything like me who gets impatient easily and wants to get things done. Waiting is difficult, and I get it, and I see it, and I understand it, but here is something in Scripture that waiting is something that is a tool that God uses. For what purpose? Well, in Nehemiah's situation, I'm going to suggest it was for a couple of things. The waiting was, well, more than a couple. The waiting was there for him to learn something that's difficult, because we're all independent people. It was dependence on God, first and foremost. That waiting taught him, well, patience in waiting on God. Now, I'm going to suggest, though, in that time of waiting, it wasn't inactive. And there's going to be evidence to this as we go through the Scripture here, that he did something significant while waiting. Two things. He learned patience. He learned dependence on God. We know that. But now there's two things that I believe he did that is very clear, that is significant, that we can learn. When God places a godly burden on our hearts, how do we respond? First, we wait. We wait. But do nothing? No. Absolutely not. Look at verse 2. And we're going to build this. Actually, I'll just tell you right now. I believe, and I know this, that he prayed while he was waiting, and he planned. He prayed and he planned. So when God placed this godly burden on Nehemiah's heart, he was thinking, now what? Well, I got to go to God first. So he took this time of waiting, and at that time he had no clue how long it would be, but he took the time to pray. And also plan. All right. How do I unpack that? Let's read on. Verse 2 now. The king said to me, "Why is your face sad?" For 4 months, he went into doing his duty as a cupbearer, which, by the way, was pretty significant. It was a pretty privileged position. Some of them were even, this was not, I read some commentators that said this wasn't necessarily an appointed position, but they were truly looking for volunteers. They wanted people who wanted to be there to protect the king. So whether it was appointed or not, why was this position significant? Well, frankly, he was there to taste it wasn't just to pass the wine to the king or to the drinks to the king. There was kind of a catch to this privileged job. Okay? The catch might get a little uncomfortable, but they were to taste everything for what? Poison, right? So the king would just sit there and as he drank his wine, and then he would wait for a moment, and the cupbearer would like, wait for a minute, and then give him the cup. Okay, everything's good. He didn't keel over and die. So this was a significant thing. And though privileged, it was risky. And one of the things that Nehemiah 2, in 2:2, it says, why is your face sad? Why is this significant? You know, when you think about every sip could be your last, you would think that that would be reason enough to be a little bit, like, visibly disturbed. But that wasn't the case. Why? Well, the position of king, when as he was doing his kingly affairs and business in the throne room, there was always like different people who were doing playing instruments, for instance, and trying to lighten the mood, because it was a very stressful thing. People were trying to kill him. There was, you know, incredibly difficult circumstances that the king needed to rule on. And, you know, it had a tendency to be a little bit down in the courtroom, in the throne room. So, you know, in some things, it was actually illegal to look sad. So no matter what your disposition was, inside, it cannot be expressed outside, because you're just too much of a Debbie Downer. And they didn't need that burden in the throne room at the time. They wanted things to be cheerful, happy, happy, and all things going on. So when Nehemiah said, for all this time I did not show sadness, you got to think, okay, was this deliberate? Was Nehemiah planning this? Was he looking for the right time? Because he's very smart. I think he knew that if he showed any kind of visibly being down, this could be the end of him, not just because he was drinking dangerous things, but the very fact that this was, frankly, either broke throne room etiquette or this was just not something that you do. It was risky. Seeing that you are not sick, the king said at the second part of verse 2, there is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then what did Nehemiah say? Then I was afraid. For all those reasons that I told you and more. So Nehemiah is like, I think this was a calculated thing. And if it wasn't, I'm happy to be wrong on this. But nonetheless, whether it was calculated or not, his sadness was visible to the king. The king recognized it and called him on it. Now, this was a dangerous thing to do. So he was expecting in his mind, okay, I am now in trouble. I am afraid. But instead of danger, something else happened. Opportunity. Instead of trouble that happened, something that was positive came forward. You got to remember, this was an unbelieving king. This was an unbelieving authority. And so all of this that God is seeming to work in his sovereignty, in Nehemiah's favor, so to speak, in God's favor, this is a really good illustration for me today. God uses anyone for his purposes, including unbelieving leaders. Have you quit praying for them? Are you discouraged? Or are we still on our knees for our authorities in our country and in our province? Do we have a tendency to cut them down or to lift them up in prayer? I get a little discouraged by even my own heart and attitude towards some of the things that I think that are going against the things of God in our culture today. And I kind of lose sight on the fact that God can use this for his glory. Whatever this is, working through the courts at this time, in the Supreme Court, we talked a little bit about it last week, the case with Trinity Western University and things like that. You know, even in our province, through the Alberta government and legislature, policies and things that are being passed, yes, disappointing, yes, a little bit bleak, but are we praying to God? Are we leaning on him? Are we waiting patiently and praying? Or are we complaining about people and our governments? If so, I think that is an indication that you may not be trusting God enough. This is clear. Look at Nehemiah's response here. Sometimes, well, no, all the time, I think God would rather us wait patiently, of course, and pray. Pray. All right, let's keep going. Verse 3, I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Okay, so because I think that this is a calculated event, he's showing his hand, so to speak, here. And I think the king, knowing the circumstances here, he sensed that. This was not just a venting that was coming. Hey, just get it off your chest, Nehemiah. Just let her rip. Just whatever's bothering you, I got big shoulders. Just get it off your chest with no intention of follow-up. I think the king's next question is very real. So, in verse 4, then the king said to me, well, what are you asking? What's the point? So I prayed to the God of heaven. What is interesting in the book of Nehemiah, that over 11 times in just 13 of the next 13 chapters here, 11 times we have Nehemiah, we read about him praying. How do we respond to a godly burden? We wait upon God, but while we're waiting, we don't do nothing. We pray. We follow Nehemiah's example. So I prayed. Here he's going to God first and then to man. And I wonder, in our difficult circumstances, when we see that person across the river, we just so want to lash out and be able to use our words rather than wait patiently on God and look for his words to address the issues. He waited and he prayed. As I was being discipled as a young Christian, one of the first verses I learned was 1 Thessalonians 5:11 and 12. The reason why I bring this up is because I struggled so much because it was teaching about prayer, but there was something in this verse that really got me thinking about prayer. 1 Thessalonians 5:15, 16, 17, and 18. See that no one repays you evil for evil, but always seek to do good to one another and to everyone. Rejoice always. Here's the hang up for me. Pray without ceasing. Give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. This is the will of God, that we would pray as believers without ceasing. Does that mean that I should move to the forest and build a little, I don't know, what do you call it, hut or cabin in the woods and just sit there and pray? Is that what praying without ceasing means? Maybe for a season. Maybe for a season that is exactly what it means, but I don't think that that's what this verse is saying. Here, let me read you a little quote here. As we go through the day, prayer should be our first response in every fearful situation, every anxious thought, and every undesired task that God commands. A lack of prayer will cause us to depend on ourselves instead of depending on God's grace. Unceasing prayer is, in essence, continually dependence on God, upon and communion with the Father. I'll just let you sit and read that for a moment. Unceasing prayer is, in essence, continual dependence upon and communion with the Father. One reason God makes us wait on Him is to teach us to depend on Him in prayer. We see this in our story with Nehemiah. If God immediately granted everything we ask for, we'd grab the things we want for ourselves and forget God entirely. But when we wait on God in prayer, we learn to seek God himself and depend upon him in ways that we never would learn any other way. And when the answer finally comes, we realize that it is because of one reason: the good hand of God was upon our lives, just like Nehemiah said at the end of this chapter. Thus, we give him the glory and the honor that he deserves. So in the 4 months that he waited, I believe that he prayed. Let's go on. Actually, I'm not there yet. Verse 5. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servants have found favor in your sight, then you send me to Judah, to the city of the father's graves, that I may rebuild it. So now we have the answer to the king's question is, what are you really asking? And so Nehemiah says, send me. Don't just send a bunch of people to get it done. God has placed this godly burden on my life, and I want to see it come to fruition. I want to be part of the solution. I want to be held accountable to the godly burden that God placed on my life. I am not going to release that burden to anyone else. I want it to fall on me. God has called me to do that. He includes himself and he makes it very personal. And he says, send me. Verse 6. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, well, how long will you be gone? And when will you return? I think that's actually an encouraging question. Anybody want to know why? I think he actually liked Nehemiah. I think there was a good bond. I think it was a good friendship. I think that there was trust there. And this was a good thing. He was in good reputation with the pagan king. There's some good lessons to learn there, but time won't let us go there. When will you return? He didn't just say, well, that's up to the Lord. Oh, I don't know. He just kind of shrugged his shoulders. He's like, let's just see how it goes. No, this is why I think what comes to the next part of what he did. First, while he was waiting patiently, first he prayed, and then I also believe that he planned. Why? Because of his answer to this question. He just didn't say, I don't know, let's just see how the Lord leads things. No, he didn't say that. Verse 7, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king, I think that's incredible throne room etiquette, okay? He's treating the pagan king with respect. He's treating the pagan authority with the treatment that he deserves. If it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, and that they might let me pass through until I come to Judah. Verse 8. And the letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that I may that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress and the temple and the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. That just pumps me up. I just get so excited. You know, for whatever reason, God is honoring the plans of Nehemiah here because he's putting himself in the position to act on the godly burden, and God's hand was upon him. I'm kind of a strategic thinker. I like sitting back and look at things in a macro point of view, and I like making plans and trying to accomplish things through proper planning, not just myself, but with teams of people. This is a great lesson for me. Let's look on here. So we know that prayer and planning was included in the waiting patiently of Nehemiah. Now let's go on to point number two. Work with those God has placed in our lives. So how do we respond to godly burdens? First, we wait patiently, and we can plan and pray. Secondly, we have to work with those that God has placed in our lives. Now, this might cause you to cringe a little bit, and that's okay, and I think that's fine. Let's read the text and find out. And just to see and highlight who he's going to be working with. Nehemiah knew how to work with an unbelieving king. That's the first point here. How did he do that? First of all, he prayed, right? He said that. He said that he prayed. The second thing that he did was that he gained the king's respect by what? I think it was by having a good character and competency in his work. He valued his work and he glorified God by what he did. He considered his work a ministry to the king so that he can glorify God by it. He gained character and he improved his competency, which allowed him open doors. So first he prayed. Secondly, he worked hard for God. Look at the outcomes of his hard, decent, daily work. It provided opportunities. The third thing that it did, that he did, was he had the respect. He showed respect to the king. He didn't badmouth the king, and he didn't tear him down. Well, he couldn't. He'd die. But this is a good explanation as to why he did, and he was still alive. He was tactful in addressing him, and he said, if it pleases the king. He always addressed the king with the proper respect that he was due. It showed him how to interact with him. And I think that this is really good lessons for us to learn and believe and to know and follow through, especially for those who are working. To be able to have that character and that competence with those that you're working with, no matter what position you're in, no matter what vocation you're doing, are you reflecting the character and priorities of Christ in your job? If you do, God will provide divine appointments. He will. I've seen it. I've heard stories, and I've experienced that. Okay, the second thing. Nehemiah had to work with his enemies. So in verse 9, then I came to the governors and to the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen, but when Sanballat and Tobiah, another servant, heard this, it displeased them greatly. Let's skip to verse 19. So go down right to verse 19 now. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arad the Arab heard of this, they jeered at us and they despised us and said, what is this thing that you were doing? Okay, first of all, why did he name these three and why is that significant? Sanballat was like a governor of the north. Okay, Tobiah was kind of an overseer of things in the east. And Geshem was a leader of the Arabs in the south. And then you had the Mediterranean on the west. So what does that tell you about Nehemiah's situation? He's completely surrounded. He's got opposition and barriers on all sides. Therefore, he needs to be able to learn to work with these people somehow and in some way. Knowing that all of us who have been given a godly burden, we will have those who oppose us. In this case, there were three very outspoken enemies of God who were trying to bring up accusations. Oh, are you rebelling against the king? The reason why that's significant is that was the very same accusation that was used on the people of Ezra 70, 80 years prior to that. Actually, Zerubbabel, sorry, not Ezra. It was in Ezra, but it was when they tried to start rebuilding the temple, the king at the time stopped it because the reports were coming that these people are like-minded people were saying, look, they're rebelling against you, watch out. So the king shut that down. That is a significant thing as we go further here. Let's go. Nehemiah had to work with his enemies. Oh, I missed the third one. Okay, you'll have to write this down. He also had to work with demoralized and discouraged believers. How did he do that in the text? Well, firstly, he talked about how he prayed. He talked about how God's hand was upon them. And he dealt with his enemies by, he could have brought out all the king's letters, and he may have, but it doesn't really talk about that. He knows that his battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the enemy who wants to oppose this. And so he just said, The God of heaven will give us success in 2020. There's a quote here. Sodlo Baxter, commentator, says, there is no winning without working and warring. There is no opportunity without opposition. For those of us who are in this room right now who have engaged in ministry, I know for a fact that you have experienced opposition both corporately and individually. In fact, I just had a conversation this week with somebody who said that God just brought them on a super mountaintop experience, and then just moments later, it crashed down on them. The opposition came moments after this incredible high where God was working. Are you aware of that in your life and ministry? Are you prepared for the opposition coming your way? Are we prepared as Bethany Baptist Church for that opposition? I pray that we are. Okay, let's go on to the last one. Wisely address challenges. What I find interesting, if we read, that, I don't know if I actually have it down here. So late at night, Nehemiah went out and looked at the challenges ahead of him. First of all, why did he go out at night? Why did he not tell anyone about it? Well, he knew that there was opposition around him. He knew that the people were discouraged and demoralized. So they would just look at his actions of going around and trying to assess, how do I rebuild this? And they wouldn't even get it. They said, give it up. We already tried that. In fact, the king sent a decree not to rebuild the walls. So don't do it. So another reason why Nehemiah was afraid before the king to ask to rebuild the walls was to suggest possibly the king had originally made a mistake. By asking to rebuild the walls, it could be implying to the king that the original decree was a mistake, and that is a very uncomfortable position for him to be in. The people knew that. Everybody saw it, so he went out late at night and addressed the issues, and he came back and he told everybody what was going on. He wisely dealt with the challenges. He wanted to solve the problems and answer the issues before the questions even came. I think that's wise leadership. I think that's good. We see a balance here that Nehemiah so positively displayed for us. It's not that he refused to acknowledge the negative things and the bad things that were there. The people in the trenches felt that he's been out of touch and undermines his leadership if he was just to go and do that, but he didn't. And I just wrote down here, other leaders are so engulfed by the problems that they lose hope. Nehemiah realistically saw the problem, and we will see, broke it down into manageable units in order to get the job done. Last page. So what's the conclusion here? There's lots to conclude. We see how Nehemiah responded to a godly burden. He waited patiently. While he was waiting, he prayed and planned. He worked with those that God had placed in their lives, and he wisely addressed the challenges that were before him. Those are the three things. I want you to look at that right now. Last week, we asked and I prayed that God would place a godly burden on our lives. Maybe that he hasn't done that yet. Maybe you need to wait longer and pray. But we have a collective burden as a church. The purpose of Bethany Baptist Church is to bring glory to God by making disciples who reflect the character and priorities of Jesus Christ. We're going to be looking at this time and time again because in February we're going to vote on it. This is just simply a modified version of our current purpose statement. We're just shrinking it down. It's saying the exact same thing, it's just shrinking it down. So here's the three points from today. And I want to close with some of this. Today we saw Nehemiah waiting until the appropriate time to involve others. Nehemiah knew from the start that this work was going to require the participation of the entire community. This, right here. Where'd it go? There it is. This requires participation of the entire community of Bethany Baptist Church. Nehemiah knew that the task that God had placed on his life, he couldn't do it on his own. He couldn't just go out and hire a bunch of workers to finish that wall. He needed the effort and the ability and the skills of the entire community to get it done. Jesus takes his disciples and places them into a body we call the church because he knows that becoming a mature disciple is something that requires us to be involved in community with other fellow believers. Within this community that we here have at Bethany, it's God's plan that every single member is a minister. The church is not to be an organization which people join in order to pay somebody to do all the work. Sadly, I think that's kind of the church culture that it's bending towards that. As the mega church and the larger church ministry models, it has to turn that way, and I get it, and I understand it. I'm not even saying it's wrong. But I'm really questioning the motives behind that because I look at this and it says that every member is a minister. I got to say this carefully. I'm very thankful for this position that you've trusted myself in. It's pretty humbling coming up here every week. And prior to that, Pastor Dennis. One of the things that I think that I want to try to do in a more intentional way is follow what scriptures say in Ephesians 4, 11 to 12. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry. It's not saying that I'm not, or I don't have to do any work. That's not saying that at all. But it's saying that part of the role is for whoever is in this position of elder, teacher, pastor, evangelist, shepherd, that we are here to equip the saints to do the work, not to just hire people to do it for them. Nehemiah recognized that. Nehemiah worked through all of those challenges, and God did an amazing work through that community. In fact, it took 57 days, I think, to finish that wall, something that was almost impossible to accomplish. Is it 52? 52, sorry. I guess the time doesn't really matter other than the fact that it was an incredible miracle. God has placed a godly burden collectively as a church. We have to all work towards this together. What can we learn from Nehemiah and apply to our lives today to make this happen? Okay, I'm going to invite those who will be helping with the communion this morning to come.